So I'm here in a noisy emporium with Tim Crouch in those weeks before the Edinburgh Fringe. And Tim, my first question to you is, Stephen Hawking has joined up with some kind of, I think it's a Russian billionaire, to try and find out finally, by spending a lot of money, a multi-billion dollar effort, whether there really is life out there. So they're expanding the listening ability of the planet Earth to see if there are any signals, you know, out in the universe. Some people believe it's out there, some people believe not. If we did discover all kinds of beings on other planets, similar or less similar to us, do you think they would all be doing theatre?
But is it Plato's argument? Yeah, I think they absolutely would be. They would be. They would stop living ordinary everyday lives. They'd be in a constant state of artistic fabrication, which is actually a state I often feel of myself in anyway. So, yeah, Pluto was discovered. I wonder what kind of fringe festival happens on Pluto in the summer months, which probably lasts a couple of years. That's a good question, though, Paul. Yeah.
I mean, do you think theatre is that fundamental to any form of civilisation?
Oh, my God. Well, it's about processing... processing art. Oh, you throw me in at the deep end.
Yes.
It's about representing our lives, isn't it? We have to find ways to represent our lives because we are intelligent creatures and we can't just live them from moment to moment. We have built into us the capacity to reflect, and as soon as we reflect or report, then we think about the form of our reflection and our reporting. And when we apply a form to the reflection and reporting, then we've begun to tell stories and we've begun to create culture. Because I think culture is probably just the application of form onto the everyday life. So, yeah, it's essential, no question. And then form, of course, will mutate from century to century, from year to year, from probably day to day, and from planet to planet.
But I mean, aren't audiences just supposed to sit quietly and watch?
Well, that's not really my take on things. I think that's happened in the last 150 years, as we've got ambiently controlled theatre spaces, you know, where we can switch the lights off the audience and get everything nice and quiet. And then there's been an element of sort of preciousness that has evolved into our art form, which I'm less interested in, really, than a community engaging altogether. There are usually more people in the audience than there are on stage. I would say, therefore, they are slightly more important than the actors on stage. And that's another downside, is I think the actors have become, you know, in the last 150 years, we've lionized those artistic processes rather than just seeing them as being an extension of how we get on with our lives. The audience should not be told to shut up. The audience should be understood. They should understand that they're the reason we're doing what we're doing. Sadly, all too often, that's not the case.
So the screaming, cutlery-banging child on the table next to us, that's vital to this interview.
Do you know, I would say it is. Some of the best performances I've done have been for primary schools or in prisons or in front of audiences who are not culturally trained in that last 150 years, you know, of protocol and sensibility, because when you capture them, you really capture them, you know. There's no bullshit about that, particularly with young people. If they're with you, they're with you genuinely, not because they've been sort of educated to demonstrate being with you. So I'm all right about the screaming child. I'm all right about the people getting up and moving around, because if the work is good enough, that won't happen.
So as a theatre maker in that kind of, I guess, genre or style, so do you see your audience as collaborators, as, you know, they're there, they're awake, they're aware, they're participating, or are they just comfortably numb, passive watchers who just need poking and that's why you do it?
I mean, very often in my plays, I give them character. You know, there's a play of mine called England, which is written for art galleries. In the second act of that play, the audience are the third protagonist in the piece. They don't actually say anything, but they speak, and their words are interpreted back to the characters on stage. They embody one character, the grieving widow of a man who's been killed for his heart. In an oak tree that, you know, I'm just currently engaged in, The audience are two audiences. They are both an audience in the theatre watching An Oak Tree by Tim Crouch, and they're also an audience a year in the future watching a stage hypnotist act. And halfway through that play, my play, that other audience leaves the building. I do always, and of course Malvolio is a solo show where the audience are absolutely characterised. They're characterised along the lines of Toby Belch from Twelfth Night. So I need an audience in that show to misbehave, to scream and bang their spoons on the table, to cue goes the banging of the spoon on the table, because I'm going to respond to that energy and that rawness. And Malvolio would deem it ill discipline, but I would actually deem it to be a live presence rather than a sort of soporific, sort of drugged presence. I want them to be with me, and I want them to think. And also the word that I would use is I want them to co-author what we're going to make together. So I try in my work to not complete the circle, because I leave a gap in the work. Even that, if that's a contradiction between what I say I am and what I actually am, or what I say this place is and what it actually is, I will leave that contradiction open, because I'm inviting an audience to finish it for me, to see the image rather than me show them the image, but to help them see it for themselves. It feels more empowering, it feels more democratic. It also feels in a way more traditional. It's how Shakespeare's audiences would have done it. You know, piece out the imperfections with their minds. Yeah. That's a call to an audience to come with the performers on a journey. And I try and hold on to that as much as possible.
Now, you do that a lot, and you're bringing An Oak Tree back to the Edinburgh Fringe. So in some ways, that kind of way of working is normal for you. But when you do it each time, are you sort of mischievously nervy about it?
Oh, man, that's a good question. I don't set out to make experimental, you know, work. That's, I think, not ever been in my remit. I've set out sometimes just to tell a story, and I've thought about what the best form that story can be told in. And then probably what I do is I follow the idea as far as I can, right down its rabbit hole, you know, to the very end. And if you follow that idea and interrogate that idea, then it's going to make demands on your work about how it wants to be expressed or how it wants to be represented. So if I try and keep my mind in an open state that can accommodate anything that the idea throws at it, then the form kind of dictates itself, rather than me sitting down and going, right, I'm going to try something I've never done before. It's never for the sake of effect, you know, it's never for the sake of shaking things up. A play of mine called The Author that shook a lot of things up to some degree. I thought it was the, when I wrote it, I knew it had some asks in it, some requests to an audience, but I had no idea it had the sort of the stridentness that some audience members found it had. I just wanted to tell a story about how we are when we're together and how we are when we watch when we're together. Again, so the binary of that relationship is very straightforward. I'm not really, in the Stephen Hawking sense of the word, I'm not really asking an audience to, you know, invent a new thing or put them into a new position. I think the positions that I put an audience in, they have been in the past, and maybe they've just they've got a little bit obfuscated or hidden by current theatre practice. So I feel like I'm revealing rather than sort of creating something dramatically radical and new.
Now, in terms of asking stinky Stephen Hawking type questions, so here we are sitting in Emporium, and I'm looking at you, and you there's a head with a brain in it and a smiling face, and there's the rest of your body, and you've got your feet and your hands, and we're surrounded by people, and we're in a space that goes right out to the outer reaches of Pluto and beyond, and then there's the mysterious inside mystery where we don't know where things come from, maybe, or we do. Where do your ideas come from?
Yeah,
can you locate them for me, please?
Yeah. Yeah, so I was an actor for many years, and towards the tail end of my acting career, I got more and more frustrated, I think, by the situation that I found myself in. I'm not pointing a finger at anyone, really, other than myself. I kind of lost faith to some degree, and I think the trigger for making my own work has been about trying to rediscover the faith that I have lost. And that faith is very much around the sort of principles of what we do and what we can do. So simplification to some degree, or reduction, or to find the essence of a thing. So I feel like I'm still trying to do that, to see what it is that exists between a performer and an audience. So on that level, that's an idea. But the idea is meaningless, Paul, unless I have a story. A story that I think, through a long process of interrogation, I begin to believe in. And then I begin to believe that it might be a story that's appropriate to the ideas I want to express. And then I believe it's a story that I should tell regardless of the ideas, whether it's just a good story. And it's a long process. I had a play last year at the Royal Court called Adler and Gibb, and I gave a little talk in Dublin earlier this year about the journey of that play. And the journey of that play was 5 years, from beginning to think about one thing, then that thing sidestepping to another thing. And over 5 years, whilst doing other stuff, you know, over 5 years, a story beginning to form, a little bit like a fog or a distant storm on the horizon, and then testing the story against the ideas I wanted to explore in the story, then testing the ideas of the story for just being a good story. So very rarely do things sort of land magically. I would say that My Arm, the first thing that I wrote, was a sort of magic manifestation. I wrote it in 5 days. I didn't think I was writing it for anyone other than myself. I performed it in people's front rooms in Brighton, you know. And that play, because I was so free in when I wrote that play, I think my subconscious sort of had the upper hand, which is a good thing, you know. And for the last 12 years since writing that play, all my work kind of references that play. It feels like that's the sort of that's the mothership of all the ideas that I've been developing or exploring. And that was written very instinctively, very intuitively. And I have talked in the past about ideas coming from some place where I don't know. I'm not particularly spiritual about things, but I do think we have a hunch around narrative, and when something starts to form, I can't scientifically work out the equation that's led me to think that or to develop that. And that's a good thing for any artist, to trust where the spirit takes them.
But also, you do need to be open then, don't you?
Oh, well, openness is probably the most important word in everything. As a performer on stage, you have to be open. An oak tree has a second actor in it who doesn't know the play. The only invitation really I give to that second actor before the show begins is I invite you to be open. There are sort of practical aspects of openness as a performer. Listening, I think, is a very practical aspect of being open. But otherwise, if you're open, then everything opens to you. And our danger is that we come with preconceived ideas. There are dangers with an oak tree, that an actor comes with a preconceived idea of how they think they should be in the show. And that's, in a way, the biggest stumbling block when you're working with someone who's already fixed themselves. So, yeah, the work, if I'm alert and alive to the presence of an audience, then I'm open to that audience. Malvolio is a constant presence, a constant openness to what's going on. From a phone going off to a latecomer coming in, I'm searching for the present moment as a performer in Malvolio, because it's going to be the raw material of the piece. Being open to narrative influence, to ideological influence, to social influence, to architectural influence, spatial influence. Openness is, I hope I will have it on my tombstone.
I've got a biographical question now, and it's inspired by something Kurt Vonnegut said, and I remember reading about. Sometimes you can imagine your biographical line as disappearing into the past, right back to whenever you appeared, and disappearing to a moment of your death. But along that line, which is a bit like a street, are things. That could be that wardrobe at 22 that you remember buying and selling, and it could be that car that you bumped into a tree, and it could be that gift that somebody gave you. So looking back over your line that goes back right to the beginning, can you just choose me two or three objects? Two or three things.
The history of the world in two or three objects.
Well, they'll be your objects, stand out along that line, particularly, I guess, in your theatre career.
Yeah, well, I will stick to that rather than go sort of deeply personal, if that's all right. There's a little flyer on my wall in front of my desk, which is for a play called Camp, which then became a play called For King and Country, and it was written by a man called John Wilson, and it opened in 1964, which was the year of my birth. And John Wilson was the husband of my drama teacher. My drama teacher arrived in a secondary school in Bognor Regis and kind of blew my mind, much as that child's mind is being blown as we speak. And John's two daughters, Sue and Jude, both live in Edinburgh. And a few years ago, they found a flyer for me, and I have it framed. And that is a very significant artifact that I wouldn't want to lose, because that drama teacher was the beginning of my, you know, my life, my career, my, you know, thing that here, however many years later, I'm still doing. So that's one. Second along the line, bloody hell. Yeah, well, then my arm. There's a model of me in my arm, which is an action man. The only thing in that play, it's an autobiographical story of me living with one arm above my head. I never, in the course of that performance, ever raised my arm above my head. But there is a sort of avatar in the story, represented by an avatar of me, represented by my original childhood action man. And he does raise his arm above his head. So I would say those two things, you know, they are a journey for me. From being a receiver, you know, being an open student and being totally inspired by people who were around me when I was 15, 16, to then beginning to return the favours, really. And my arm was the first thing that I felt, you know, was the return of favours. So, look, there you go, Paul. Pluck that from my mind. That's two.
Okay, final question. You've almost, a bit of synchronicity, 15 and 16. I'm going to choose 16. So you're 16 again.
Yeah.
But without the memories that have come after. And you walk into a fringe show called An Oak Tree playing at the Travis, and you see it for the first time. What does that 16-year-old say coming out?
Oh, fantastic question. Well, I really hope they wouldn't up to that moment have been aware. It's going to sound very presumptuous, but they wouldn't have been aware that way of telling a story was possible. And that's not that I've invented a new formula. It's not at all that. But I just that was a big risk for us with An Oak Tree. It was a big risk that this process, this form would work. And I think it does work, partly because we totally bind it in with the story that we tell. So I hope my 16-year-old self would feel a little freer having seen that show, to go, oh, well, I can also do that. Or there are other ways that stories can be told that I maybe haven't had the chance to think about yet. And I would say that's what my drama teacher did. That's what any good role model does, is to give you an idea of an alternative way of being and an alternative way of seeing. So I hope my 16-year-old self seeing An Oak Tree would discover an alternative.
So here from An Oak Tree on planet Earth, whether there are aliens out there or not, we're going to be up in Edinburgh seeing An Oak Tree. So thank you very much.
Thank you,
Tim Crouch.
Thank you.